Hello and welcome to the Radical Americas podcast. I'm your host, William Booth. And in this, our first episode, I'll be talking to Christian Hogsberg about C.L.R. James. But first, I went to the LSE to speak to Tanya Harmer about her current project on Beatrice Allende.
I'm here with Tanya Harmer in the LSE Department of International History. Tanya, I was wondering if you would be able to tell us a bit about your current project.
Thanks for coming today. I'm writing a biography of Beatrice Allende, Salvador Allende's daughter, but it's not a conventional biography of just one individual because I'm using her life to tell a broader history of the rise and fall of Chile's revolutionary generation from kind of the 50s up to the mid-70s.
And is she quite an emblematic figure then for that narrative?
Yeah, I mean, she lived and she died in 1977. Tragically, she commits suicide in Cuba in exile. But she lives a relatively exceptional life in some ways. She's the daughter of Salvador Allende, and he's, you know, very active in politics in Chile. But she does help us to understand a much broader milieu of radical Chileans and radical Latin Americans that came of age really in the shadow of the Cuban Revolution, who were really captivated by that revolution. And in that respect, she's emblematic. I mean, just following her trajectory, I mean, her life and her experiences on campus in the University of Concepcion down in southern Chile, to her participation in kind of electoral campaigns in the 1960s and student politics, and then her experience in her father's government, and then in solidarity and solidarity campaigns after 1973, she does help us to understand a much broader phenomenon and a far broader story.
And how would you characterise her politics?
That's difficult. I mean, she was a member of the Socialist Party, like her father. She was incredibly loyal to her father, but always had sympathies to the left of his politics, and very much taken by the Cuban Revolution. And at Concepcion, at the University of Concepcion, some of her closest friends and acquaintances become those who will be founders of the MIR later on. Miguel Enriquez, Batista Van Schoen, and people like this. Now, some kind of suggest that she had a double militancy, so that she was perhaps part of the MIR. I have found nothing to that effect. I think because of who her father was, she was always going to be a loyal member of the Socialist Party and would never leave or join the MIR. But she had very, very close relationships with those people in the MIR, and actually acted as a bridge for her father between that far left and the Socialist Party, which became very important during his government when she was private secretary to him. I think afterwards in exile, she becomes a very important unifying figure, actually, or a central figure, because she is able to speak to the far left, but also to the Communist Party and to the Socialist Party, and even some in the Christian Democrats. Because of who her father was, she has kind of this status, and because she was never a really leading figure in the Socialist Party, she's not kind of compromised by internal struggles there. So complicated. I mean, yeah, I characterise it as far left, very much sympathetic to the Cuban Revolution, but not formally so.
And because Chilean politics, not only on the left, but certainly on the left as well, was very fractious and fractured at that point, is it quite unusual to find figures who are able to talk to cut across those fractures and to bring people together?
Yes, it is. And like I said, I think the only reason she can really is because of who her father was. Her sympathies were very obviously to the far left, but she's able to speak to different groups because of the inheritance that her father gives her after his death in 1973. They're incredibly fractious and divided. And part of the reason I would argue that she ends up so desperate in Cuba in the mid-70s is because she is desperate about what is happening to the left, and the complete kind of infighting and divisions that are occurring. Now, there are some who would blame her and the far left for inciting those kind of divisions. But having read a lot of her kind of letters from that period, you see her frustration with the kind of, for example, the divisions on the Socialist Party and the inability to work together.
What about the politics of gender? Does that come into the project at all?
Yeah, it's... So, I mean, there are so few real kind of studies of women and the revolutionary left in Latin America. I mean, I think this has to do to a large extent by the kind of hyper-masculine Cuban revolutionary example, the Che Guevara figure, the quest to be for the new man, the new revolutionary man. And it was a new man in the way in which it was articulated. And so, yes, gender is a part of the project. Particularly, I've been very interested in, for example, Beatrice's desire to follow in Che's footsteps, but being blocked from being able to do so because of being a woman. And so she goes to Cuba. She's very much involved in a kind of effort to start an insurgency in Bolivia after Che's death. She wants to go to have training like many of those she recruits and coordinates in this revolutionary group. But she's consigned to intelligence work, to radio signalling, to medical kind of auxiliary support. And she's deeply, deeply frustrated and upset by that because she wants to be like Che, but is not allowed to be because she's a woman. And I think that so through her, I've also kind of got a much broader idea and it will be part of the book of writing this as a history of a biography of women as well in the revolutionary left. Very much often, to use kind of the recent film, Hidden Figures in that revolutionary left, that whose story needs to be told, really.
And it's interesting that those, even within revolutionary movements, or perhaps even especially within revolutionary movements, those classic wartime roles of women are replicated.
Yeah, they're replicated again, but they're also essential, right? So if you have groups of, and you know, okay, so the very kind of reductive idea of a few men going up into the hills to lead revolution, well, they need logistical support, they need radio signalling, they need safe houses, they need provisions. And who's doing that is very often, well, there's a broad network, but it's very often that's where you find the women who are very involved in this, in these operations. I mean, obviously, this one, like so many others, was a failed, a disastrous effort to follow in Che's footsteps. The kind of insurgency that ends up being an insurgency at Teoponte in Bolivia, you know, ends in disaster. But there are many women that are involved in that, not who are involved in actually, you know, going to the mountains or guerrilla training, but who are involved in the underground network, in the preparations.
And you mentioned the importance of her father's position relating to her position later as a title, sort of attempts to conciliate the various factions of the left. Is the Allende name, the Allende lineage, still important in Chile?
Yes, very, very much so. But Beatrice's relationship with that lineage and the way in which it's understood is rather hidden as well. And there are a few reasons for that. I mean, she commits suicide in 1977, and this is problematic for a number of reasons. You know, for revolutionary left, suicide was viewed in very negatively. It was, you know, it was the duty of every revolutionary to make revolution and patria muerte, and you fought to the end rather than suicide being perceived as being something of a betrayal. I think there are also religious problems with suicide and also with her position as a mother. So she was depicted very much as by the dictatorship as someone who'd betrayed her position and her children and her position and as a mother. And this is gender coming back into the fold. So I think the way she died has made her memory has made it problematic for people to explore her in more detail, but also for her to have an imprint in the way in which the left kind of continued and evolved in Chile into the 1980s and the 1990s. So that's on the one hand. I think, on the other hand, I think her memory and the role she played and her kind of far-left tendencies, her alliance with the Cuban Revolution, her sympathy for armed revolution, complicates the memory that many are trying to put forward of Allende as a social democrat figure, of someone much more moderate than, in fact, I think he was. I mean, he had his own sympathies for the Cuban Revolution and was sympathetic to armed revolution in Bolivia as well. So I think particularly after the kind of transition to democracy and kind of the turn in the Socialist Party towards kind of social democratic centre, I think rescuing and kind of telling the story of Beatrice forces us to reevaluate and rethink Allende as well. And so it's rather awkward in a sense to have to ask, okay, this was an incredibly loyal confidant of his, and Beatrice was, you know, very, very close to him. So how does the fact that he was so close to someone who's sympathetic with armed guerrilla insurgencies complicate our understanding of him as well? We need to kind of look at her, and I think looking at her will, as a way in which also to kind of rethink him as well and his position.
Yeah. Just sort of zooming out a little bit, wondering if you could perhaps tell us a bit about how this project is informed by your previous work and how it fits in with those other projects.
Yeah, of course. So I started kind of research and really through my first book and my PhD, which was arose from my PhD, which was looking at the period of Allende's government, or the period of the Unidad Popular government, and trying to write an international history of that. So looking at how Chileans in government viewed the outside world, and how not just US kind of Nixon and Kissinger intervened in Chile, but how we can think about, or we can understand Chile in a much more regional context. And the book that came out with Allende's Chile and the Inter-American Cold War was really the result of what I found in the archives, which was that looking at US intervention in Chile only told a small part of a much broader multilateral battle for Chile, which went on for ideological reasons in the early 1970s, and which, you know, involved protagonists like Brazil, the dictatorship in Brazil, intervening very decisively against Allende's Chile and the effort to try and bring about a peaceful revolution in Chile, but also the Cubans, of course, and their support for Allende and their involvement in Chile during the early 1970s. So I came to this new project really much from a position of really being interested in that inter-American or that transnational international history of the Cold War in Latin America. I came to Beatrice through many of the interviews I did with those the Cubans particularly who were involved in Chile during the early 1970s. But I think when I was thinking about the next project, I wanted to move a little bit beyond diplomatic and top-down kind of Cold War history of Latin America, although I think there's still so much more to be done in Latin American history on that, because we know so little about Latin American government and state kind of ideological Cold War policies. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to move and to examine what Gil Joseph calls kind of, and Greg Grandin have talked about, as the internationalization and politicization of everyday life that took place during the Cold War, which they talk about as being what explains its violent character. And so through using an individual, but really exploring what everyday life was like on university campuses or in public health debates, because Beatrice was a medical student, or in solidarity campaigns around the world, I'm trying to get at understanding what was at stake in the Cold War. What was the ideological battle that was being fought? How did people, individuals, kind of experience the Cold War on the ground? And this isn't necessarily bottom-up history. It might be kind of middle ground history, because, you know, this is Beatrice and many of those on the far left were middle class, university educated. But it's certainly not the state, and it's not embassies, with a brief exception of when she's working in La Moneda as her father's private secretary. But even still, you're getting a kind of insider's kind of everyday life kind of view on the presidency rather than kind of what one ambassador said to another. Yeah. So it built on that, and I think the result is that it's going to be it adds to what I've done before But it's a different perspective. So bringing a gender dimension to it, bringing more transnational dimension to it. And as I said, really moving to understand how the Cold War intersects with different facets of everyday life, like university politics, like public health, like solidarity campaigning.
Sounds really fascinating. I really look forward to that. You mentioned the Inter-American Cold War there, and I think when that book came out, it sort of instinctively made a huge amount of sense to a lot of Latin Americanists who thought, yeah, this is obviously the way we should be conceptualizing the Cold War in Latin America. This, and it was kind of, I think so much of what's come out since then has really reflected that, that's this new way of thinking about it. But there does seem to be a sort of lag in that catching on in more global histories of the Cold War, and that there's still sort of a lingering perception of the Cold War as very much this great power transatlantic thing. Do you think that's changing, or do you think there's still a lot of work to be done in kind of reframing that debate?
Yeah, no, I think it's a very good question. I mean, I came up with the Inter-American Cold War framework very much because at the time there was a lot of discussion about Latin America's Cold War and a Latin American Cold War. And when I was looking at what happened in Chile, for example, I mean, and also elsewhere in the region, I felt it was impossible to exclude the United States from that. So I didn't feel like we could just do a regional, but the US was so important in much of the way that the Cold War evolved that you had to include it in the framework. Now, since then, maybe I'm kind of writing myself out of a job here, I've been very much persuaded that, you know, we need to move beyond the kind of historiographical Monroe Doctrine when looking at Latin America and looking at the revolutionary left, but looking at the right and the centre as well. You can't understand Christian democracy in Latin America without understanding the influence of what's happening in Italy and Germany. Mm. We can't understand the right as well without understanding like Federico Finkelstein's fantastic work on transatlantic fascism and understanding the links there. So I've been involved and increasingly interested in the globe, the way in which we could maybe understand that Inter-American Cold War within a broader global perspective. And I think this is a new field. I think it's a very young field. I think it requires, you know, huge amounts in terms of linguistic capacity and different regional expertise. I think it will probably be a collaborative work to begin with. But I've been very interested, for example, in trying to work out or understand with others the global history of Latin America's revolutionary left. Mm. So what were the influences that came from other parts of the world to that revolutionary left? What was the influence of Vietnam, for example, on that revolutionary left, or Algeria? Through ideas, but also through the physical movement of people between Latin America and other parts of the world. But also, you know, in terms of shaping kind of revolutionary strategy, repertoires of action and things like that. So I've been involved recently in a couple of organising a couple of conferences with Alberto Martin at the Instituto Mora. And we're hoping to kind of bring together some edited special issue collection in a journal in EIAL, Estudios Interdisciplinarios de América Latina, next year, and also an edited volume on global histories of Latin America's revolutionary left. But obviously, there is so much more to be done on really the global links and relationships that Latin America had during the 20th century and in other areas as well.
Yeah, and it's not so much that people haven't thought about the events or the processes before, but those kind of links and structures and networks and reframing those is really important, and understanding these kind of circulations of ideas of people and new alliances, new fractures and so on.
I think that's true, and I think it becomes logical when you start perhaps writing things like, when you start approaching things from a kind of transnational perspective, you know, when you try and map the movement of people or the building of networks, you know, it becomes very, very obvious that this, although, you know, there is a very clear Inter-American or Latin American dimension and framework, that people are not just circulating within the region. And this becomes, I mean, for my own particular case, it becomes much more evident in the mid to late 70s, when you have the dictatorships kind of consolidating their power and forcing so many into exile. But then you kind of, particularly in my interviews when I've been looking into solidarity, you start to ask why some exiles went some places, whether they were forced or whether they chose. And you gather a much longer term kind of view of their relationship with the outside world as well. Or you look at student politics and you look at journals. For example, looking at student politics and kind of medical training in the early 1960s, and you look at medical journals or magazines, you know, articles and conversations in those publications are not just centred on what's happening in Chile or what's happening in the Americas. They're centred on what's going on around the world, decolonisation, or Algeria's struggle for independence, or public health debates in the Soviet bloc and in the Soviet Union. There's an intellectual kind of conversation which is, you know, which transcends borders and transcends regional kind of divides of the world that we really need to get our head around. And so while there is something that is specific to kind of, there is an inter-American dynamic in which, you know, what was fought over and how it was fought in the Cold War in Latin America was very much region specific, and I think we need to start questioning, you know, what the influences were beyond that as well.
That's great, and I look forward to reading all of those things you mentioned as they unfold. Tanya Harmer, thank you very much for speaking to Radical Americas.
Thank you to Radical Americas for speaking to me.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I was speaking to Tanya Harmer there at LSE earlier this year. Also in spring, I spoke to Christian Hogsberg at the British Library about some of his current projects.
Hello, this is William Booth for the Radical Americas podcast. I'm here at the British Library talking to Christian Hogsberg. And we'll mostly be talking about C.L.R. James in one way or another, or Toussaint Louverture in a related way. And perhaps we'll start there with the sort of extraordinary discovery of the play Toussaint Louverture, which has become a big part of your work.
Thank you. Well, yeah. Finding the play, yeah, grew out of my doctoral thesis on C.L.R. James in Britain in the 1930s. And the play itself, there was a lot of mythology around it. People knew about the later versions of the play, which was renamed The Black Jacobins and had been performed, written in the 1960s, performed in the 1980s. And so there was quite a bit of writing about that, but people sort of tended to assume they were the same play, the later version and the earlier version, or more or less the same. And there was a kind of mythology and sort of mixture of romanticisation on the one hand about the earlier production, which had Paul Robeson in the title role, but also a kind of attempt sort of sometimes to denigrate the earlier play by saying that the white actors were all blacked up in it and stuff like that, to try and basically boost the importance of the later plays, if you like, and try and say this earlier play was a bit of an embarrassment on one level, and it was too didactic. So in one level, the earlier play, but perhaps that had led why people hadn't spent a lot of time looking around for it so much. But it was a visit to Hull, what's now Hull History Centre. It was in the University of Hull Archives, and in the Jock Haston collection, it was Trotsky's comrade of James's from the 1930s, there was this, just one file named Toussaint Louverture, and I'd assumed it was just going to be like a programme from the original play, which would have been an amazing find in itself, or quite a rare thing to see and quite a nice thing to see. But it turned out it was this... a yellowing mass of paper, but what was missing was the name of the author on it, so it just said Toussaint Louverture, the story of the only successful slave revolt in history, about the obviously about the Haitian Revolution and stuff, but it didn't have C.L.R. James, so he hadn't, and I think the scholars who would have visited the Haston papers over the years and would have seen it would have just either not recognised it for what it is and just thought this is a bit unusual and left it, because they were interested in, perhaps Haston's Trotskyist activity and more than anything else, his political activity, rather than this old play that was just sitting there, or assumed that it was a play that was the same play as the later version, and just assume, well, it's just, okay, it's old, but it's not, you know, it's been, the later play had been published, and people, you know, assumed it was probably just the later play. And so, because of this lack of interest, I suppose, in the earlier one, people hadn't yet, you know, visited the archive, hadn't seen its importance. So for me, though, when I saw it, the moment I saw it, I realised this was this kind of long-lost, missing piece of the James corpus, really, one of the last really major, significant pieces of his writing, yet to be sort of published, missing. And so it was a hugely, yeah, one of those exciting moments. It's about when you go to an archive and find thing, you know, that does happen occasionally in the archives, but which is why being a historian is a nice thing to visit them, but it's quite rare. And to find something at the early on in my research was really something. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I then wrote to Robert Hill, literary executor, and he invited me to edit it. So that took a year out of my sort of PhD to then researching, getting into, you know, black theatre, Caribbean theatre, trying to properly understand the context. And you realise actually, final point, it was actually, when you actually start to do the research and you read all the reviews, there wasn't a case of white actors blacking up. There was a significant number of black actors, many really fascinating figures, people like Orlando Martins from Nigeria, worked as a seafarer, later became an important film star in Nigeria. Starred in it, Robert Adams, another pioneering from the Caribbean, as well as Robeson. So you have actually these kind of important, significant black actors who are starring alongside Robeson in these roles, and that just opened up a whole world for me of kind of black and radical theatre in Britain. You know, Duke's and Louverture, the production of it in 1936 wasn't a sort of unique thing too much in itself. There were these other, you know, plays going on at the time. Steve Dorr, I think, produced the year before. So there was this growing network of black actors in Britain, small, mainly off operating other work as well. And James's play just happened to be the most sort of anti-imperialist, political, revolutionary play within that wider kind of culture of radical black theatre in the 30s, this huge sort of moment of political crisis. Yeah.
So even in that early play, some of those themes of kind of globalised black political subjectivity are there in the performance, in who's involved with it.
Yeah, absolutely. You have black Americans like Paul Robeson, black Caribbeans like Robert Adams, C.L.R. James obviously himself fills in a small part in the play. Black Africans like Orlando Martin from Nigeria, all coming together in this play. And yet, in the play itself is obviously about the Haitian Revolution. So it was the first time for almost 100 years that this play about the Haitian Revolution had actually been staged in Britain. There was a brief production of a play called Toussaint Louverture of a Black Spartacus in 1830s, at the time of Chartism. Written by a white playwright. James's play was the first time black professional actors had starred on the British stage in a play by a black playwright. So it was a hugely important production, significant production in terms of black British theatre, black Caribbean theatre, and so on. But the play itself, yeah, it's about the Haitian Revolution. It's quite rare to have a play that's that political about a, you know, a revolutionary struggle, staged in Britain at a time of censorship of the theatre and so on.
And is that really the beginning of the kind of popular idea of the Haitian Revolution as a kind of a revolution of global importance and universality?
That's really interesting. Yeah, it's certainly James had just started researching Haiti, and his work on Haiti became the Black Jacobins, obviously, in 1938. And he was trying to really, I think, educate a British audience about the truth about abolition. But it was just after the sort of centenary of the official abolition of slavery in the British Empire. So there'd been all these articles and stuff in 1933 about importance of Wilberforce, humanitarianism, that kind of tradition, and the Haitian Revolution all been written out of it. And James's play is basically trying to, might be actually, the enslaved themselves are central to their own sort of emancipation. And the Haitian Revolution, he's writing it in the early 30s at this moment, and trying to, basically make it one of the great world historic revolutions, like the French Revolution, like the American Revolution and stuff. So in some ways, yes, he is trying to globalise the Haitian Revolution for the first time, really, in that play. And then he does it, obviously, in Black Jacobins, carries that project through and fills in more details. Yeah.
Yeah, and is it fair to see it as part of the same broader project as Black Jacobins, the what we see as a historical text?
I think so. Yeah, I mean that's why when the Black Jacobins came out and C.L.R. James showed it to people like George Padmore, his compatriot from Trinidad, important anti-colonial, key anti-colonial Pan-Africanist figure of his period, and Paul Robeson, they said to him, you know, James knew the history was there. You know, we knew he had this great, glorious history there. But it's partly because, you know, they would have known about the play just a few years earlier, but also because that the memory of the Haitian Revolution had gone back even, you know, earlier among black radicals. You know, so Robeson first came across the Haitian Revolution, first when he did an oration, Wendell Phillips' oration, when he was at school or college, and when he was just 17 years old, he read out the story of Toussaint, Wendell Phillips' oration to Toussaint Louverture. So, they, you know, that kind of memory was there. Padmore being of a communist movement, the communists in the 20s, and the late 20s, early 30s, were starting to, black communists were starting to talk about, you know, the Haitian Revolution and the importance of it. So I think, you know, in that moment, in the interwar period, particularly the Haitian Revolution had real resonance, and, you know, people looking for earlier kind of revolutionary heroic figures, and Toussaint Louverture was obviously, you know, one of the figures that defeated British imperialism, Spanish imperialism, French imperialism. You know, it's hugely a huge inspiration in this, for the anti-colonial movement at that time.
Yeah, and remains so to many people, of course. And your involvement with James hasn't really ended there, has it?
Hasn't ended. No, so yeah, so my work on James in the 30s, finished my PhD in 2010, and it was published in 2014 on C.L.R. James in Imperial Britain, which tried to basically showed James's development, intellectual development, from a sort of liberal humanist, I try and argue, in Trinidad before coming to Britain in 1932, and then his turn to revolutionary socialism and militant Pan-Africanism in the 30s in the context of the Great Depression, sort of that transformation of James, and then the writings of things like World Revolution, Black Jacobins, History of Negro Revolt. James is becoming himself a really critical anti-colonialist, anti-capitalist agitator, an activist, theorist by the late 30s, and so in so many ways some of the projects I've got coming out now are sort of all spin-offs from that. So I've co-edited this volume called Black Jacobin's Reader, which came out of a conference organised in 2008 in London. So that's taken sort of a few years to come out, but some proceedings of that and some other papers, and that looks at the Black Jacobins and its importance as a historical text. And I'm also editing this new edition of James's World Revolution to come out in time for the centenary of the Russian Revolution this October, which again is a spin-off from my PhD. So in many ways, some of the projects I'm doing, have come out from just initial work on James in the 30s, some of the key works he wrote in the 30s.
Yeah, and something else you're involved with for the centenary of the Russian Revolution is this conference, The Red and the Black. Can you perhaps tell us a little bit more about that?
Thanks. That's really just a sense that this important anniversary is coming out, and actually there'd be lots of conferences and discussions around the Russian Revolution per se, but you know, I think Russian historians just see it. I think there's a term, I mean, if you look at Steve Smith's work, he's tried, his new book I think does frame it in a wider imperial thing, looking at the Russian Empire and the impact of that and Russian Empire and crisis. So there's a sense of imperial history coming into within Russian historiography, but still it's very much looking at Russia and its empire and things. And yet, you know, I thought it was a space for thinking about, it was timely to think about Russian Revolution and the Black Atlantic, and bring together some of the rich, really rich historical work that's been done now on, and that has been done for decades really, on sort of thinking about the questions of Pan-Africanism and communism, activists, various kind of communist activists who became communists, who inspired black colonial subjects, who inspired by Russian Revolution, black American activists in Russian Revolution, and just try and reassert the importance, I suppose, and the inspiration actually of Marxism and Bolshevism at that time, because it's kind of, that's something that's often seems a bit potentially it's been missing a bit, I think, within the wider historiography of empire, and even within black internationalism ideas, and of Marxism's kind of tend to be a bit subject. I think centenary Russian Revolution is a good time to actually try and reassert and think about questions of Bolshevism and why that was, and Leninism, why that was inspiring, why that moment of 1917 was actually inspiration across America, Caribbean, Africa. Yeah.
Yeah, that should be really interesting. We'll finish up, if that's all right, by talking a little bit about this new book you've got coming out with Pluto as well.
Oh, yeah. On 270, which, yeah, I was invited a while back by Jonathan Maunder, who was then working for Pluto. I think he now works for said books. But he invited me and said, "What, well, we've got this Revolution Live series. People want a biography of Toussaint Louverture. But my French is not, yeah, it's not good enough." So I was like trying to fob it off to other people I knew. And I one person I fob off his proposal, I approached, was Charles Falstick, who my co-editor with Black Jacobin's reading. He's just, "Why don't we co-write this book?" So that seemed to makes sense. So it tries to take the sort of the framework of James seeing Toussaint as a Black Jacobin in this age of revolutions, and I think with interesting thing, kind of, you know, Toussaint Louverture, there's been a number of biographies recently. There's Madison Smart Bell's one in 2007-2008, and then more recently Philip Girard came out last year, called Toussaint Louverture: Revolutionary Life. And Girard's in particular is based on a huge amount of archival research, which our book hasn't really claimed to be able to, you know, really have done to that level. But I think Girard's work is is shaped, unfortunately, by a kind of more conservative revisionism about Toussaint. He tries to suggest that Toussaint was above all kind of quite ambitious, pragmatic figure rather than a idealistic sort of Black Jacobin, or is it, you know, above all ideas. So I think our work is trying to obviously build on the archival work that's been done on Toussaint since the age, since James wrote his book, you know, back in 1938, and bring in the latest scholarship on the Haitian Revolution, but try and defend really James's framework for seeing Toussaint as a Black Jacobin, and try and defend that against a sort of potentially more conservative reinterpretation of Toussaint.
And so you're confident that the Black Jacobin is the Toussaint we should still be seeing in 2017?
Absolutely. Think about the beginning. Yeah, that's the figure, I think, that inspired James, inspired anti-colonialists, who inspired him in the interwar period. The Toussaint who basically, in some ways, there's an interesting article, I don't know if you saw, by Keenan Malik in The Observer, really, about the importance of the Enlightenment, importance actually of the radical Enlightenment in some ways. And I think our work's trying to situate Toussaint Louverture within that wider radical kind of Enlightenment framework, and actually show that's actually, then Toussaint does speak to us. It's not the case that we have to see him as a kind of shifting, pragmatic figure who's, in some senses, kind of willing to kind of compromise and deals to make him fit to our age that we're living through now. I think at our time of Trump, our time of rising racism and stuff, actually, it's the Toussaint Louverture who actually showed you can profoundly actually defeat, not only challenge and stand up to racism, but actually defeat racism and imperialism. But actually really, yeah, potential, I think, is really important historical moment for the Haitian Revolution, and potentially can inspire new movements today.
Well, that's great, and it's a good series as well. There's been some great books in that series, yeah. So I really look forward to seeing that. Christian Hogsworth, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for taking the time. Thank you.
I was speaking there to Christian Hogsworth at the British Library earlier this year. Apologies for some of that background noise. Libraries turn out to be slightly more noisy than you might think. Thanks to Christian. Thanks also to Tanya Harmer for speaking to the Radical Americas podcast. That's all for this time. Tune in next time when we'll be hearing about AIDS literature and eugenics. Thank you. You can find out more about the Radical Americas Network at radicalamericas.org, and about the Radical America's Journal at the UCL Press website.